From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, President Trump sent a video of congratulations as the new American embassy in Israel completed the move from Tel Aviv, opening in West Jerusalem.
And we extend a hand in friendship to Israel, the Palestinians, and to all of their neighbors. May there be peace. May God bless this embassy. May God bless all who serve there. And may God bless the United States of America.
There was not peace today. More than three dozen Palestinians were killed by Israeli army fire as they protested, sometimes violently. Palestinians are burning tires, throwing rocks and firebombs, and have made several attempts to breach a security wall. Rami Curry is a professor at the American University of Beirut, a syndicated columnist for Agence Globale, and a senior fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School. He joins us in the studios. Rami Curry, welcome back.
Thank you.
And remind us the status of Jerusalem captured by Israel in the 1967 Mideast War, what this means to everyone in the region.
According to international law, Jerusalem, according to the 1948 partition plan that the UN voted, was supposed to be a demilitarized international zone that neither Israelis nor Palestinians controlled. That didn't happen. The city was split, and then in 67, Israel occupied the eastern part, which had been part of Jordan. Virtually everybody in the world recognizes East Jerusalem as an occupied territory. West Jerusalem is widely recognized as the legitimate part of Israel.
Because there's still hopes for negotiating a two-state solution and a divided Jerusalem, capital of each state, U.S. allies, France, U.K., other countries in the region have opposed this move of the American embassy to Jerusalem. And remind us, too, these protests today were an escalation of protests that have been going on since March, attempting to break this decade-long Israeli-Egyptian blockade. This was imposed after the Palestinian group Hamas seized control of Gaza in 2007. 60 protesters have been killed since March in these ongoing protests. So what are they protesting?
They're mostly defenseless, unarmed civilians protesting vigorously, showing that they have a right to return to Israel or to have a negotiation with Israel that leads to a two-state solution. And the situation in Gaza is intolerable. Several million people in Gaza, about 85% of them depend on the UN for food. The water in Gaza is virtually all unusable. There's the blockade, which is predominantly put by Israel. The Egyptians play a certain role, but the Egyptians open the border now and then for people to get out. And it's a symbol of the continuing reality of the core issue, which is Palestinians that were driven out of Israel in 1947 and 48 feel that they have certain rights to return or to negotiate a new situation of a sovereign Palestinian state living alongside Israel. The Israelis say, no, they don't have that right. They have to recognize Israel as a Jewish state.
That's the significance of this date today. It is the 70th anniversary of the founding of Israel, as you mentioned, in 1948, but also seen by the Palestinians as the Nakba area.
Right. There was in 1947-48, the process of the Jewish zealots, the fighters who wanted to create a Zionist Jewish state, became much more active. Fighting broke out in Palestine. A lot of Palestinians were expelled. A lot of them fled during the fighting. Israel was created in 48. And that date is remembered as the Nakba, the date of the catastrophe for the Palestinians.
But you mentioned that the Israelis are demanding that they be recognized as a Jewish state. It's more than that. For the Israelis, it's an existential matter of existence. They want to feel secure. And that brings in the other headline of recent weeks, which is President Trump withdrawing from the Iran nuclear pact, in part because there's no demands on Iran to stop its support of groups in the area, including Hamas. And this is part of what Israel wants. They want more guarantee of security. Your thoughts on the impact of that other storyline that's going on while we're watching what's happening today?
First, I would say there's no state in the Middle East that is more secure than Israel, partly because of its enormous international support, the U.S. in particular, and because it has probably somewhere around 200 nuclear bombs, which they pretty much admit, more powerful than any combination of neighbors for the last 30, 40 years.
Yeah, but you have Iran passing missiles through Syria to Hezbollah, to Hamas.
Right. So every few years a war breaks out, and I've lived through many of these wars in the Middle East, and Israel keeps expanding and building settlements. And so Israel is not threatened with existential obliteration like happened with the Holocaust. Where the new problem comes up for the Israelis is they see Iran as a future threat. The Iranians are not ever going to attack Israel. I mean, that is, I think it's a certainty. The Iranians are not crazy.
They sent some missiles from Syria just last week.
The Israelis have attacked Syria many more times than anybody has attacked Israel. So the Israelis have carried out hundreds of air attacks in Lebanon and in Syria. So the point is both sides have a conflict. They have a political conflict. The Iranians have issues that we can criticize them for sure. But the idea that they are an existential threat to Israel is really pretty silly.
But how does this end, Rami Khoury? What, we see these protests today. The embassy is formally opened. How does this get tamped down?
Nothing's going to happen while you have the current incompetent Palestinian leadership, the Israeli very right-wing nationalistic leadership of Netanyahu and Likud, and the American leadership under Trump. There are 7-8 million Palestinians who still feel that their national rights have not been secured, and they are peacefully demonstrating for the most part to end their refugeehood through a negotiation with the Israelis for two states. The core issue for the Palestinians is ending their refugeehood. The core issue for the Israelis is being accepted as a formal, normal state in the region. And the mediator from the outside who can get this done is not the United States.
Who do you think does it, if not the U.S.?
There isn't any one mediator right now that can step up and do it. It's going to have to be some kind of coalition of international parties that both sides trust.
Yeah.
The Israelis only trust the Americans, essentially, right now. And the Americans under Trump now, with Jared Kushner and Sheldon Adelson and these guys running the show, are very, very close to Netanyahu and essentially giving him what he wants. So the U.S. is totally out. But the U.S. has been a failed mediator for the last 25 years. They had a monopoly on mediation, and they failed. They're serial failures. So there has to be a more international effort focused on the rule of international law that gives both sides equal rights.
Rami Khoury, a professor at the American University in Beirut, longtime syndicated columnist in the region and a senior fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School. Rami, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
The suspect in California's Golden State Killer case is scheduled to be in a Sacramento courtroom today. He's been charged with 12 murders. But so far, prosecutors haven't charged him with the nearly 50 rapes they say he also committed. They may have run out of time legally. Across the country, there are calls to review such statutes and possibly get rid of them altogether. Bob Moffitt with Capital Public Radio reports.
Prosecutors have as long as it takes to obtain a murder conviction, but not a rape conviction, depending on the state. In Oregon, Leanne Littrell DiLorenzo took up the cause of eliminating statutes of limitations for rape when she discovered her state's statute was 6 years.
It was shocking to me personally that there was an arbitrary deadline that the government had established in which they felt this particular timeline was when a woman had her opportunity to bring her case forward.
She runs the nonprofit VoteERA.org, which focuses on equal rights for women. The Oregon legislature doubled the number to 12 in 2015. 21 states and the District of Columbia limit the time prosecutors can bring charges in a rape case. Florida could also be included in that list. Florida has no time limit to prosecute if a weapon is used, but if a weapon isn't used, prosecutors have only 4 years to file charges. In Illinois, it's 10 years if the crime is reported immediately, but 3 years if it's not. Ohio, 25 years, but in Connecticut, Arkansas, and New Hampshire, it's 7 or less. Some states, like Washington, are considering changes. Although Democratic State Senator Jamie Peterson recently killed a bill that would have eliminated the statute of limitations, he says he's open to more time for rape cases, but not unlimited time. He says degradation of evidence is one problem.
A second problem is the perspective of the accused person may lose the ability to defend himself or herself over time.
But time also plays a role when it comes to rape victims coming forward after such a traumatic event. Chelsea Byers leads the national campaign to abolish statutes of limitations on rape and sexual assault.
The severity of the shame and stigma that is placed in the experience of the survivor cannot be understated.
She says the fear of reporting an attack to an authority figure or a family member can also be a significant barrier for many to overcome and often reignites trauma from the attack. Even when victims come forward, failure by law enforcement to process evidence can delay or even prevent justice. The Joyful Heart Foundation says more than 225,000 untested rape kits sit on law enforcement shelves in 30 states, with an unknown number in the other 20. Some agencies destroyed the kits when the statute of limitations ran out. That's prompted some changes. Some states have lifted the time restriction if DNA evidence was collected at the time of the attack. But even if every state changes its rules, the U.S. Supreme Court says they can't be applied to cases retroactively. In Sacramento, Joseph James DeAngelo is charged with two murders in the East Area Rapist case. Investigators believe he attacked at least 50 women in the 1970s and 80s. The statute of limitations then was 6 years. Steve Grippy is the chief deputy district attorney. He calls the likelihood of rape charges a long shot.
I would never say no way, but it's going to be tough to prosecute those cases.
Elizabeth Silva is one woman who hopes prosecutors succeed. She recently came forward to allege DeAngelo raped her in 1974. She supports removal of time limits.
If they catch these guys, regardless of how long it's been, we deserve justice. We've had to live with this.
According to the Department of Justice, 31% of sexual assault victims report the crime to law enforcement. For NPR News, I'm Bob Moffitt in Sacramento.
Believe it or not, it was 20 years ago today when the last episode of Seinfeld aired. More than 76 million people tuned in for that. Seinfeld was one of the most popular shows of the 90s and still airs in reruns today. Comedian Carol Leifer was one of the writers on Seinfeld, and she joins us from New York to reflect on it. Carol Leifer, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me. I am a fan of your show.
Oh, awesome.
So I love when I'm on shows that I actually listen to.
Well, it is great to have you. And can you believe that it's been 20 years since the finale?
I cannot. It's pretty wild, pretty head spinning.
Well, you wrote for the show during seasons 5, 6, and 7. And I want to just hear a little bit from some of these episodes that you wrote for. Some of them very famous scenes, by the way. Here's a scene from The Rye.
Okay.
When Jerry needs a marble rye at the bakery and finds out that an old woman has the last one.
Yes.
All right. Look, I'll tell you what. I'll give you $50. Now, be reasonable. You cannot turn down $50 for a $6 rye.
No. Watch me.
Stop it. I want that ride, lady.
Help! Someone help!
Shut up, you old pig!
He stole my marble rye. Where did that idea come from? Do you remember?
I do remember. You know, Jeremy, when you write on a show like Seinfeld, one of the hazards of being a writer on a show like that, or really any show, but more so in the heyday of a hit popular network TV show like Seinfeld was, I was always accosted by people who said, oh, you know, I have a great idea for Seinfeld. And it was like, oh, boy, here we go. And it was like, you know, Betty keeps her egg salad in the refrigerator at the office. And like, oh, my, here we go. But a girlfriend of mine from high school, she said, you know, the funniest thing happened to me. My husband and I had a couple over for dinner, and they brought a bread, and I forgot to put it out, and I realized at the end of the evening that they had taken the bread home with them. And as my friend was telling me this story, I said to her, oh my God, that, I cannot wait to pitch that. That is an amazing Seinfeld story. And sure enough, I went back to the office. And, you know, when you pitch to Larry and Jerry, it was a tough room. You had to go in and you had to grab them quick, because if you didn't, it was curtains. And when I pitched it, they both loved the idea and sparked to it. And that became the marble rye. But when you played that clip, it brought back such a memory to me, because when Jerry wrestles the marble rye away from the old lady and says, shut up, you old bag.
Right.
We looked at each other and we said, he is so beloved a character now, Jerry Seinfeld, that he can take a marble rye away from an elderly woman and say, shut up, you old bag. And the audience smiles and, oh, Jerry, oh, you silly card, you. You know, we knew that that was a special moment in Seinfeld history of belovedness.
Well, and is that how the writer's room worked at Seinfeld, that people were just pitching ideas of things that had happened to them or things that had happened to friends that they knew?
It was a lot like that. When you went into pitch, if it wasn't a tight little idea, you could see them drift off. So when I pitched, like, George brings a deaf woman with him to a party to lip read his ex-girlfriend's lips from across the room to find out why she broke up with him, Larry would leap out of his chair and go, that's a show. We're doing that. That's a show. Uh-huh. And he would get really, really excited about it. And if it was something that had happened to you in real life, I always felt that gave you a leg up, because they didn't have the option of going, oh, I couldn't see that. Like, another one of my episodes was The Beard. Mm-hmm. And that was culled from real life because at the time, and, you know, here's the 20 years ago-ness of it, I had a gay male friend who worked in banking, and banking, of course, being a very conservative field, he had still closeted, but he asked me to go with him as his date to something with his bank president and his wife. So that sparked the idea of the beard. But there were so many, you know, like the Soup Nazi, which was a great episode written by a friend of mine, a very funny writer, Spike Ferriston. You know, the Soup Nazi was based on the soup place that was around the corner from the Late Show with David Letterman, where he worked as a writer. So that's always been a good lesson to me also as a comedy writer, is to always be in your life, but always be outside of it, mm-hmm. looking in, because those turn out to be some of the best ideas for a comedy show.
All right, here's another scene. This is from The Understudy, and this is an episode where Jerry's girlfriend is an understudy for Bette Midler, who yes. George ends up injuring during an improv softball game in the park. Here's a scene with Kramer, who is obsessed with Bette Midler, visiting her in the hospital.
Right.
Hi. Here. I made this for you.
What is it?
It's Macaroni Midler.
Macaroni Midler?
Yeah. See how you're singing?
Yeah.
Now, what I wanted to ask you about here is, in almost every episode, maybe every episode of Seinfeld, there's a guest character that comes in. How important was the guest character to the show's success?
Well, the guest stars were always important. And as it turns out, there were so many guest stars that went on to have huge
right.
careers. You know, Bryan Cranston was in the Anti-Dentite right. episode. But it's hard to believe that in 1995, which is when we shot The Understudy, it was a little difficult to get a guest star to commit to being on Seinfeld. And we really went after a lot of big actresses who passed on it. But what was amazing about Bette Midler when we reached out to her is that the writer that I wrote that episode with, Marjorie Gross, who's sadly since passed on, she was an old friend of Bette Midler. And when we reached out to Bette Midler, having been friends with Marge and going so far back with her, she was like, oh, absolutely, I'll do it. Hmm. And I'm happy to do it. So it was that connection that made us land the amazing Bette Midler and turn in a performance that, you know, is bravura.
All right, well, let's talk about the last episode. I can't believe it. 20 years ago, you were no longer a writer on the show during the final season. But what did you think when you heard that the show was ending?
Well, you know, I guess like most things, bittersweet. I think with a hit show, it's always very tricky to know when to turn out the lights. And I think Jerry had a very good sense of when it was time. And I think, you know, look, it's 20 years later, and I don't think I'll ever work on a show as legendary as Seinfeld. I mean, they come along once in a lifetime. And what I always call it is lightning in a bottle. And that's very rare. And especially with Jerry and Larry creating it, having the writers they did, but also the cast. Each cast member could have done their own show separately. They're each that talented, and to have them all together and create this ensemble was amazing. So obviously it was sad when the show ended, but I think 20 years later, as I think we all knew then, it was the right time to go.
What did you think of the finale? Because some people didn't like it.
You know, I was a fan of it. I know that it was very divisive or whatever it was, but I liked the tack they took, and I enjoyed it. You know, to me, the real legacy of the show is that it's still so loved. It's, you know, I have high school students. You know, my son is 12 and is starting to watch it and enjoys it. It just, you know, funny is funny. You know, when I was growing up, I used to watch I Love Lucy, and
right.
that was a show that was an old-timey show back then, but it's funny, and I'm just so proud to have been part of a show that's really withstood the test of time, and people still love it and still get turned on to it and still enjoy it.
I watched I Love Lucy, too, but on Nick at Night. But I was a high school student when the last episode of Seinfeld ran, and we put on, me and a friend of mine put on a Seinfeld day at our school. We had a soup Nazi.
Really?
We had the cable company come in and put in cable for one day so that we could watch on the big screen at school.
Wow.
So, oh, yeah, it was a lot of fun.
That's really admirable. But, you know, it's also a time gone by when they used to call shows water cooler shows because they were watched by millions of people.
Right.
There weren't a million shows to watch. And I remember after I wrote The Rye, I went to our local deli and I walked in and there was a big sign at the front, like, we have the famous marble rye from Seinfeld. It's like 2 weeks ago, it wasn't that famous.
Yeah.
But now, hey.
So what are you doing now, Carol Leifer?
Well, I'm very, very busy. I just worked writing on the Oscars that Jimmy Kimmel just hosted. I was honored to work with Carol Burnett on her last two projects, which was the 50th anniversary of the Carol Burnett Show, the special that aired on CBS. And it was just Carol's head writer for her show called A Little Help that is streaming right now on Netflix. And also doing stand-up, just recently opened for Jerry Seinfeld at the Beacon Theater in New York, which was, it's really been terrific.
Well, it's a great pleasure to have you on the show today. Carol Leifer, one of the writers on Seinfeld and doing a lot right now, it sounds like. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having... Oh, and also I have a book out called How to Succeed in Business Without Really Crying.
You got that plug in. There you go.
That's right. I talk about Seinfeld in that book. So pick it up, folks.
Today, the Supreme Court ruled that a federal law prohibiting most sports betting is unconstitutional. The decision paves the way for New Jersey to allow sports gambling at casinos and racetracks and could mean many more states will follow. There were two other big decisions from the court today as well, and joining us now to tell us about them is Domenico Montanaro, NPR lead politics editor. Domenico, let's start with the sports betting case. Tell us more about that one and the decision.
Well, the Supreme Court struck down a 1992 federal law. That effectively prevented most states from legalizing sports betting. Nevada has had this carve-out for some time. And as you noted, New Jersey is a state that could stand to benefit from this. Chris Christie, when he was governor, brought this case, and New Jersey won this case. And that clears a legal gray area that's going to open the door for state governments to join in what's really become a very lucrative industry. The American Gaming Association estimates that illegal gambling has gotten up to $150 billion a year. That's billion with a B. So a lot of states are probably going to be looking to cash in as their states and budgets are more and more strapped for revenue.
So maybe some of these states are the winners. Are there losers because of this decision?
Well, Nevada obviously doesn't like it. They don't want this they lobbied hard against it. It's pretty interesting, though, you know, having Donald Trump as president, because back when this bill was first being pushed through Congress in 1992, Bill Bradley was the senator who pushed this. It's colloquially known as the Bradley Act. He's the former New York Knick and New Jersey senator, and he really was against this, telling NPR in the fall, betting on sports was betting on human beings, and I thought that was wrong. Donald Trump, when his casinos were struggling and having difficulty back then, was lobbying in favor of this. So we'll see where this winds up going in other states.
There were two other cases today, one about privacy rights and a traffic stop. Tell us about that one.
Well, that first one, Bird versus U.S., the court unanimously agreed with a driver of a rental car who said he'd had his privacy rights violated by police during a traffic stop. He said he did not consent, and the police found dozens of bricks of heroin and body armor in his trunk. And the man, though, said he didn't consent to this search. The cops argued that that didn't matter because his name was not on the rental agreement. The court disagreed with them and said that the man still maintained a reasonable expectation of privacy.
And the other case, the case of McCoy versus Louisiana. What was that case about?
Yeah, the court ruled by a 6-3 margin in favor of a man who wanted to not guilty to a capital offense. His lawyer wanted him to plead guilty to avoid the death penalty, and the man strongly disagreed with his attorney on that, and the court backed up the man and said that guaranteeing a defendant the right to have assistance of counsel for his defense. In other words, it's your right to decide how you plead, not your lawyer's.
So some big decisions today from the Supreme Court. And Domenico, we're still waiting on some more, including one on redistricting.
Oh, yeah. There's a whole bunch of other cases still. There's the redistricting case. There's the case about, the cake shop, which has to do with whether or not, the sort of right to religious freedom versus the right to privacy.
So lots more to watch for. Domenico Montanaro, NPR lead politics editor. Thank you.
You're welcome.
There are more than 300 needle exchange programs in the U.S., according to the North American Syringe Exchange Network. These are places where people with addictions can turn in used, dirty needles and get clean new ones, the principle being that more clean syringes will help prevent outbreaks of hepatitis and HIV from dirty used ones. But over the last 2 years, at least 8 programs have shut down, including one recently in Charleston, West Virginia, a program that remains suspended after a state review. Tomorrow, we'll speak with Charleston Mayor Danny Jones, a critic of the exchanges, but first a supporter and a needle exchange vending machine. Ricky Bluthenthal is a professor of preventative medicine at the University of Southern California. He studies the effectiveness of exchange programs. And Professor Ricky, you're one of those who says research shows they are very effective.
Right. So following that principle of the more syringes that are out there, so that there's a sort of saturation of clean syringes, they're very effective.
Yeah.
The studies, show that places that have robust programs have lower HIV incidence among people who inject drugs. Areas that have them have lower HIV seroprevalence. And that, in addition, when you remove them, HIV seroprevalence and risk behaviors go up.
Okay, well, what about some of the other questions about these exchange places? That, first of all, they might encourage addiction. They might either encourage addicts who are already addicted or bring new ones in because of removing the concern of illness.
Yeah, those are all valid concerns. In this case, we've actually observed the program pretty comprehensively in a variety of different sites. And the results of those studies are basically, there's no evidence that prevalence of drug injection increases in areas that have syringe exchange programs as opposed to places that do not. There's no evidence that young people are more likely to become injection drug users in places that have them versus places that do not. There's no evidence that they contribute to increases in crime in the places where they're located. The other thing is there are also a set of studies where we looked at whether people were less willing to enter drug treatment as a consequence of using the programs. And again, we found that that's not the case.
Well, in fact, some of the people are saying that these needle exchange programs aren't just places where needles come in and new ones go out. They become medical centers where people can get treatment. People can actually start thinking about treating their addiction, but also other health issues. And I just want to ask you about one of the other side effects that people are pointing to in Charleston, West Virginia, which has been pointed to in other places, that while needle exchange programs may not increase the number of addicts, they draw addicts from other areas. So, for instance, in Charleston, 483 drug users went through that exchange in just 8 hours, and it's a city of just 50,000 people, which, of course, converts the area in which you have the needle exchange.
So, in an ideal world, you have to be aware that there are a variety of different models for how these programs can operate. So when I was in graduate school, I helped start a program in Oakland, California. And we had different sites, and we had a robust program. But we located those sites in places where there were already lots of people who inject drugs. Mm. But they located it in what seems like the center of town.
Right, next to the new civic center.
Mm-hmm. Right, and that's a choice.
Yeah.
So you can go mobile, you can do delivery, there are a variety of different ways of providing the service. If the concern is really, we just don't want it in this central area. From my view as a public health person, the fact that it had 483 people using it is really positive. That's, the programs only work if people go to them.
Well, this is the tension, though, because, yes, it worked, but another side effect that they are seeing there is, even though this is supposed to be a place where needles are exchanged, the dirty needles are finding their way around the exchange area onto the ground, and there was a five-year-old who was accidentally stuck by one. Look, there are 300 needle exchange programs in this country. In Australia, there are 3,000, and Australia has a population of about 25 million to our over 300 million. So I'm imagining that you think instead of less, fewer, there should be more.
For sure. Yeah, I mean, we do need more of these. And we need more of other things, too. I mean, one of the points I'd also like to say is folks often say, well, these folks should just get treatment. And let me tell you, we don't make evidence-based medically assisted treatment for opiate use disorder widely available. And we've really got to change that, as well as increase the availability of syringe exchange programs that can really prop up the health of this population when until they're ready to engage in treatment.
Yeah. Ricky Bluthenthal, professor of preventative medicine at the University of Southern California, on the effectiveness of exchange programs, as you heard, he thinks they are very. Professor Ricky, thank you.
My pleasure to speak with you. Have a great day.
Well, last year, Las Vegas went full bore behind needle exchanges with the first in the country needle exchange vending machines, which are popular in Europe. In Las Vegas, they're located in three separate clinics staffed to provide additional services if needed. Chelsea Cheatham is the program manager for Track B Exchange, which, along with the Southern Nevada Health District and the Nevada AIDS Research and Education Society, put the machines in last year. It's too early to know if they've prevented disease, but Chelsea, what do you believe are other benefits of having a vending machine instead of a human?
Well, the benefit is actually, in this case, time. It does take a lot of time to have someone sit there with a client and do one-on-one syringe exchange with them. And we realized that it would be a lot easier and a lot more time efficient for us if we could package everything up for our clients before they even arrived and then make it easy for them to just go in and swipe a card or punch in some numbers at a machine and get the supplies that they need.
Well, let's talk about that because you can't just walk in and punch a button and get these needles. What is the process? How does it work?
So we have our clients come in and they fill out a short form and register for the program, and they're also limited to only receiving 2 syringe boxes per week. Each box contains 10 syringes.
Well, and they get this personal ID number that they swipe so that the system is keeping track of the visits. And there's a place in the machine where they can return the used needles?
There's a sharps container that's sitting directly next to the machine where people can put their used syringes and we will take them and dispose of them properly.
Well, a couple questions. Machines don't have bias. So people who are, you know, ashamed, there's a benefit there. But because there's no human, how do you know how well these addicts are doing?
A syringe exchange program should include information about HIV and hepatitis education, information about where people can receive testing, treatment, and overdose prevention. And we are able to put flyers and pamphlets in the boxes that cover all of those things. And when they're ready to get into recovery, they know that anywhere where a machine is housed is a safe place for them to go.
But what about concerns other cities have? And again, we're going to be hearing from a critic tomorrow. But the concerns are that having these needle exchanges, whether they're vending machine or human interaction, draws addicts from outside of the area, starts to flood the area. But also, with a vending machine, there's no compulsion to put a used needle in. If you're meeting with a human, you have to give the used needles to get the clean needles.
That's a common thing that we've heard from other places that were interested in getting vending machines. And from what we've noticed so far, people are returning those syringes to us. We've signed up around 400 people to use these machines in the last year, and we've distributed over 37,000 syringes this way.
Hmm. Has there been a downside you've had to address to a vending machine?
The only downside that we've had to address is the fact that we are finding that we have to stock the machine more often than we thought we would. As the machines became more popular in the community and people started to use the machines more, we've had to stock the machine sometimes 2 to 3 times a week. Funding for this project is very limited. We were able to purchase the machines through funds received from Nevada AIDS Research and Education Society and also some private and personal funds, but there's no federal funding for this program at all. and it's become very costly for us.
Well, but I'm wondering, I mean, other cities have, it's become too costly, and they've had to really reduce or shut down the exchanges because, as we said, people are coming from outside the county and they can't handle the load. What might it become too overwhelming?
It's a possibility that it could become overwhelming, but the cost to treat someone for hepatitis C sometimes is over $100,000 per patient. So if we can reduce the cost on the back end by providing someone with a syringe that may cost us about 6 cents, it's worth it in the long run.
That's Chelsea Cheatham, Program Manager for Track B Exchange. Chelsea, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
A top economic advisor to the Chinese president will be in Washington this week as a Chinese telecom company is getting some unexpectedly positive attention from President Trump. The president tweeted over the weekend that he's going to work with China's president to help ZTE get back in business because, quote, too many jobs in China are being lost. ZTE announced last week that it is ending major operating activities after the Trump administration banned it from buying components from American companies. The Commerce Department says the company violated sanctions with North Korea and Iran and failed to punish those responsible. ZTE denies those claims. And Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, joins us from New York. He's got a new podcast out called Crazy Genius. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
So let's go back in time, as we often do now with President Trump. When he makes a statement, we go back and we listen to what he's said in the past. And during the campaign, then-candidate Trump said China was stealing American jobs. Here he is in May of 2016.
We can't continue to allow China to rape our country. And that's what they're doing. It's the greatest theft in the history of the world.
So the greatest theft in the history of the world, they're raping our country, and now President Trump is tweeting about saving Chinese jobs. What do you make of this?
I'm confused. It sounds like you're confused. And I think that anybody paying attention should be confused. And I should say this is strange for two discrete reasons. The first reason why this move is strange is that it's highly unusual for any American president to intervene in this way to help a foreign company, but particularly for a president who has been, as you played, so stridently anti-China, bizarre for him to reach out to want to help a Chinese company add jobs. But the second reason this is so strange is that the company itself, ZTE, is very unusual. This is a phone manufacturer. Most people listening probably haven't heard of them. But if you work for the NSA, FBI, or CIA, then you may have heard of them because all three of those national security organizations have said that ZTE might be using their tech to spy on U.S. consumers. So in sum, Trump isn't just reaching out to a foreign country to help their economy. He's reaching out to help a company that itself might be engaged in cyber espionage against Americans. It's just an unbelievably strange announcement and makes you wonder what else is going on that we don't know.
Well, and it was the U.S. Commerce Department that said that ZTE was violating sanctions. Remind us why ZTE was punished.
Right. The Commerce Department banned American firms from selling parts to ZTE. That decision was in April. And this came after ZTE was caught, on top of everything else, illegally selling goods to Iran. And so this was Donald Trump's own Commerce Department banning American firms from doing business with this company. After that decision, the company realized or found that it was in terrible straits. I think something like 25% of its business is done with American firms. Mm. So the Trump administration comes to a decision that says we are going to punish this firm ZTE. The firm is punished. And then Donald Trump, observing the punishment, says, no, that's too far. I need to walk this back. And one has to be wondering, you know, what is Trump doing? And the two sort of plausible motivations that I can think of is one, this is about trade. This is an ad hoc maneuver to get China to lift tariffs on U.S. goods like agriculture. Or two, this is about North Korea. And Trump wants his upcoming visit, that historic visit with Kim Jong-un, to go well. And as a result, he's lining up diplomatic support for that meeting, and this might be a part of that diplomatic overture.
Well, and in fact, if it is about trade, the Wall Street Journal is reporting today that maybe that's exactly what's going on. The U.S. is changing its tune on ZTE in exchange for China removing tariffs on billions of dollars of U.S. agricultural products. Derek, is the Commerce Department saying something different now that President Trump has been talking about saving the jobs at ZTE?
Yeah, I mean, this is the Commerce Department is going to do whatever, you know, Trump suggests. Right. And, you know, Trump now has made up his mind that ZTE should be helped. And so I suppose there will be some sort of effort to put together a policy that could help them. But it should be said that Trump often makes these decisions in a vacuum without consulting his top economic advisors. And indeed, The Wall Street Journal was also reporting that top economic advisors like Secretary of the Treasury, Steve Mnuchin, was not a part of this decision. So once again, you have a familiar story to anybody following the Trump administration, which is to say that there are two parts of the Trump administration. There's Trump, and then there's the administration. And the administration can come up with all of these policies and all of these meetings and have a certain posture that it wants to take with regard to China or trade or international diplomacy. But Trump can tear that up with a single tweet, as he did several hours ago, and decide that a company which was formerly being punished by U.S. policy should, in fact, be helped in an unusual way by Donald Trump himself.
That's Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. And Derek, just give me the 10-second description of your new podcast, Crazy Genius.
Sure. On Crazy Genius, we talk to some of the smartest people in tech and culture, ask them whether we are turning the world into a utopia through tech or accidentally creating the opposite. And then I come to a conclusion on some of these biggest questions, like what's going on with Facebook and should we break up Amazon?
Derek, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that won't be us.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.